When you have your money, your real enemy is inflation. The game you're playing is, this money I'm putting away, can it buy the same things that I want to buy a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now? And most people, they did all the right things, saved their money, did all the investing, but by the time they are retiring and they no longer have steady income, your purchasing power would have been destroyed. A lot.
But why haven't we been able to build consistent generational wealth?
Great question. In fact, can I be a little controversial?
Yeah, of course.
Don't trust
AK Urum AK. From PwC auditor to fintech founder, AK didn't just launch RiseVest. He launched a conversation and building futures our parents couldn't even imagine.
People overindex on their present reality and not enough on their long-term reality because everyone overestimates what is possible in 1 year, but they vastly underestimate what is possible in 10 years. So if you start to think in decades, that's one major unlock.
And what is the one mindset that unlocks everything about money, wealth, and their own agency?
Is there an industry that most people are not looking into, but they should?
What was your best investment?
Bitcoin. So I started buying Bitcoin when it was at $90. So I sold.
Wait, you sold?
Yeah, yes, I did. So wait, let me tell you.
Hold on. We are with you.
We see the tweets, and every single day what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
So people are going to tap into your specific episode and they may be winding down from a long day. They may be on their way to work. They may be working out or even on a road trip. And I first want you to tell our audience about the opportunity to create wealth in Africa.
I think that we were just speaking about the fact that there seems to be a generational angle to money making in Africa. So there was the generation that the Elumelus, the Fola Adolas that made their money from banking. And then there was like the MTN generation, right? Which many of us, we were too young for that period. So now, I mean, everyone's talking about technology. But I also think that, so technology is still the biggest play for me because we're still at the early days of how the internet is transforming Africa. It's making access, it's making distribution, it's making content, whatever it is that you want to do, tapping into a global audience and global distribution for whatever it is a massive opportunity that I think is still early. Beyond that, everyone talks about the population in Africa. There's opportunity in agriculture. There's opportunity in education. There's opportunity in a lot of interesting places. But I think that what brings all of this together is, in my opinion, at this moment, Africa can more or less start to operate as one place where a few generations back, you know, if you're in Nigeria, nothing about Kenya is really on your radar. Today, you can look at the entire field of play of Africa and think about how do I, you know, do things across the entire continent. And so with that opportunity means that this generation will be the first truly Pan-African like wealth generation. So that's where I see as, you know, the moment that we're in Africa and as far as wealth creation is happening. And it's something to be excited about.
No, I love that you break this down because what we're seeing on our podcast is more and more Africans are tuning in. We always see people in the comments. I'm from Cameroon. I'm from South Africa. I'm from Zambia, like so many different places. So I truly believe in this as well. What I'm also curious about is there an industry that most people are not looking into, but they should?
That's not the easiest question to answer because, especially from my vantage point, whatever industry that you think about, I bet there are people looking into it already, right? So what I would say is there are things that are obvious to me because of my own unique experiences or unique professional background that might not be obvious to other people. But there are also areas that might be obvious to other people that are not very obvious to me, right? For instance, I can tell you from where I sit that our capital markets is still very early. And everyone talks about the fact that, oh, there's 20 billion in remittance from diaspora coming to Nigeria, or, you know, about 10, 15 billion coming to Kenya. But there's really no real connection between the Kenyan stock market and the Ghanaian stock market and the Nigerian stock market. So if I'm a user, I still have to do the old school way of going into each market individually. So there's a massive opportunity. I think one of the people that are tapping into that right now, there's this company called PAPS, Pan-African Payment Service, something, that are building out a way for people to invest across the continent from one single point. That's the thesis we're pursuing as well at Rise, right? We're trying to make it possible to stitch together all these markets. That's an untapped opportunity. Another place that I find really interesting is, so I look at it as applying technology to areas where Africa is a very inefficient market, where, you know, if you think about other places, all their markets have been very developed, it's very optimized, it's hard to create an edge. In Africa, we're still at the layer where optimization. So where are the healthcare chains, right? There's a model for healthcare where you have a single hub and multiple spokes, right? We don't have that model here yet. Even our agriculture is still done primarily 80% rainfall based, right? So I don't think it's sectors that are ignored. I think it's just areas that everybody might be playing in, but you can bring in something new that would give an advantage or create an edge where it doesn't exist before. I think that's how I'm thinking about it.
Okay, me, I've been looking forward to this episode so
same,
much.
Same year, man.
Because,
same
year. You know, I was early when you started Rise Vest.
Yes.
The thesis was very clear. And I'm going to tell my own version of the story, right? I remember you sent me the deck, and whether it was a memo or a deck, and I reviewed this deck, and I was like, wait, Ike is basically saying, the way I read it was, you're betting against the Naira, right? Or that the Naira itself was going to be going down. Mm-hmm. And I remember my first instinct was like, how can somebody's entire business model be the failure of a country and that we need to move? And I remember I was like, that's not patriotic, but... Time has come to tell that the real patriotism is what you were doing, which is like, you cannot allow your people drown when you know what's coming. And I think the thesis was very simple. You wrote a blog post about this even back in 2014.
Right.
What I want you to do is explain to people what you saw at the time, what the thesis was back then, mm-hmm. and how it's also played out since then.
Absolutely. Thanks. So yeah, that it's very tricky, right? So, at the time, I had done a project with ConocoPhillips at the time. We saw how much oil production was happening in the U.S. and at very low cost with shale oil production. and at the time, a lot of Nigeria's currency stability was backed on, you know, we're spending like several millions of dollars every week maintaining the currency peg, right? So to me, it was fairly simple. It was a numbers game, right? If oil prices start dropping, Nigeria's revenue will drop, which means our ability to protect our currency will drop. And our thesis then was just move your investments to a safer currency, a more stable currency, and protect your earnings power. Because there's the state or the government's policy, and then there's the people, right? And if the people are wealthy, the country will always be fine. So even to me, it was still a patriotic sense.
Yes.
And that played out pretty much exactly as we anticipated. At the time, I wasn't even thinking about it as business. There was a long gap between when I wrote that post and when we eventually started Rise. And that was really because we shopped around. I pitched to several people, including people who were already doing investment products in the market. And we told them, hey, we can help you add this to your products, right? Nobody was really very keen. So eventually, when the problem started to get worse, we realized someone has to do this, right? People need this, and if nobody is willing to do it, we'll do it. So we built Rise, and so far, 5 years, and a lot of people have said and continue to say that it's one of the best financial decisions that they've made. The way that it's evolved also is that in time, around 2023, we started to see the fundamentals start to shift in favor of Nigeria, right? Nigerian investments. Again, nothing is permanent, right? So that was when we acquired Chaka, right? And when we acquired Chaka, we put out a video and I said, listen, now I'm starting to see more opportunities in the Nigerian market. And at the time, everybody was running away from Nigerian market. But we're saying, listen, and for us, that's the beauty of what we do. We look at what the numbers say. We don't look at sentiments or emotions. We look at what the fundamentals are saying. So we told people, hey, the opportunity in the Nigerian market is becoming larger, and the value is starting to be compelling enough that we think now is a good time to start, you know, exposing back to Naira investment. So we acquired Chaka to sort of put our money where our mouth is. And in the last 2 years, you've also seen how the Nigerian market has also exploded. So in that sense, you tell that, yeah, we've been right on both scores. And that tells you that our job is to basically look at everything going on and say, this is where the puck is going. This is where the market is going. And if you can trust our calls, we'll get you to where the best returns can be made, whether at home, abroad, or anywhere. That's our job. So that's how it's evolving. And again, I do want to end with a note that now I think that, again, Nigeria is still compelling, but also the opportunity is now more widespread across Africa. You're going to see increasingly more developed market investors come back to emerging markets and come back to Africa. So again, it's a good place to be, you know, to be Afropolitan or to be doing RiseVest or do Chaka or merge our capital market. So people need to lean into that.
I think the other thing I would love for you to help break down to our viewers, especially for people who are thinking about investing, I think, like for me, my own journey, I think I became much more comfortable even talking about investing within the last 8-7 years. And I was being obviously hanging around people like you and being introduced to some of these frameworks. But can you walk someone who's listening through why investing and compounding is a much more strategic way to manage their money versus like a savings account? Not to say there's anything wrong with a savings account, but what does that look like over a longer term timeline, right? Like if I'm, let's say for example, if I started off with $10,000 today and I'm 20 years old, right? What does that look like if I invest my $10,000 today and maybe I'm every month I'm contributing $1,000, and maybe you can even go lower too, but every month I'm contributing $1,000. What does that net out to over a 30-40 year timeline?
I wouldn't say I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think if you're doing around $100 a month consistently for a 25-year period, and you're earning at least between 8-10% on that, you're almost guaranteed to be above $1 million by the time you retire, right? Almost guaranteed. Now, the reason that that's much more strategic and much more important is that when you have your money, or when you're earning, the real challenge is your real enemy is inflation, right? And the game you're playing is this money I'm putting away, can it buy the same things that I want to buy a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now? And if you're in our space, you know that what your 1 million naira could buy 5 years ago is not what it can buy today.
Definitely
right?
not.
So if you are saving and you have 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million, your purchasing power would have been destroyed a lot in that very short time period. Now, project that about 30 years. So the average person, you start working at, say, 20, 22. You're probably retiring at like 60. So you have about 40 years. And most people, they did all the right things, saved their money, did all the investing. But by the time they are retiring and they no longer have steady income, you find that the money that they've put aside is not nearly enough, right? So the compounding and the taking the stable approach, that's what the 401ks or the developed markets, that's what they do. They've optimized investing such that no matter your income level, whether you're doing 1,000 or you're doing 500 or you're doing 100, but you're putting away something consistently, you let it build up and accumulate over time, almost on autopilot, but at least you're almost guaranteed that by the end of your working years, whatever you've saved up or whatever you've invested and you've built up in your investments should be able to take care of you, take care of your evening years, and allow you to even pass something on to those coming behind you, right? So to me, that's what RiseVest and what our work unlocks. We unlock the ability to take whatever your income level is, but tell you, put away a portion of it consistently. And by the time you're done working, I mean, there's nobody, even in this room, but definitely almost nobody in this country that would retire with close to $1 million that would not be doing wonderfully, right? So as many people as we can get to achieve that, then that's the key thing. That's what we're trying to achieve.
What are the nuances between, you know, there's a Robin Hood, like for right. our diaspora folks, they know about Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. Vice versa, when I try to explain it to people who are in the diaspora, I say, oh, it's like Robin Hood, but for like Africa, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also a nuance there. Robin Hood is maybe more like you can go on there and you can pick stocks as yourself. I think mm-hmm. Vice versa has much more of a curated like yes. picking list. What was the thought process behind choosing to do that versus like a Robin Hood style index fund, like investing philosophy? Oh, yeah.
When we started out, we thought about just going the same route, just trading, giving everybody the ability to trade. And we do have a product, HISA, that is coming out that allows some people to do that if you really want to. But the vast majority of people are not going to spend their day picking stocks, right? Yeah. You know what you're passionate about and it's probably not picking stocks, right? So we want you to focus on that. And we've also tested it that most people, aside the fact that the interest is not that strong, even when they try to do it, the outcomes are not that great.
Yeah.
So we've said, all right, we do this every day. Let's be the ones to watch your portfolio, curate that portfolio, select the things that we know are going to give you a good outcome. You just fund and focus on, you know, shooting your podcast, hanging out, doing other things, you know, like it in some ways is boring, right? Yeah. I mean, looking at stocks every day, it gets boring, but it doesn't get boring to us. So, do what you do best. I do what I do best. I can't do what you guys do. And I don't think many of you can do what we do. So I think that division of labor is what makes, the approach that Rise uses. That's what made it work. And it's shown good results.
Were there any cultural like nuances? And what I mean by that is obviously you are US trained, you're seeing how it works in the US, and then you're now back in Nigeria and maybe you know how investing and that whole process works. And then I think I was talking to you about, you know, I had someone who was close to me who says, oh, they want to invest in Rise mm-hmm. where they have cash and they don't know how to use apps and like what's going on over here. So what was that process like for you? The culture shock of saying, Omo, I have to go into the markets, need to take somebody's phone. Help them download it, go through the whole process versus somewhere in the US, like the marketers are not dealing with the same problems people just say, go download the app. And then people usually have the memory of, okay, download the app, sign up, do the whole thing. But over here in Africa, it's not as simple as 1, 2, 3, right? So mm-hmm. what was that culture shock like for you? And then how did you guys navigate it?
Yeah, we honestly had to figure out our market, right? The good thing is, you know, YC will teach you, talk to your users, right? Users will tell you what you need to know. So when we started, we're like, oh, we're going to build Robinhood for Africa. And then we started talking to users and we found out that, no, that's not what users are asking for. Mm-hmm. Users are like, just do it for me, my brother. I don't want to hear all that. Just how do we? So we started to ask, okay, how do we create an app that does it for you, right? Another thing that helped us was, you know, we took the community approach. We're Africans. We like, you know, we like knowing what everyone is doing and we like to be sure that, whatever I'm doing, there's a social component to it. So we had a Telegram group. People joined in and everybody was like, oh, we know the founders. We know the team. They're telling us suggestions about what they would like to invest in. So we almost like through that process understood how the product needed to look, how it needed to work. And I think that's one of the things that gave us the early like product market fit, if you can call it that, because we knew that, oh, coming with all these US influenced ideas was not really what we're going to work with. We want to work with what the market is asking for. And the more we do that, you know, the more the results show. So,
Etche, remember that time I walked into a bank? I'm not going to give the name. And I asked them for $1,000. And they told me, no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have VBAN to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor of the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast.
You also co-founded Bitcoins, right? Yes. And I think, obviously, I would believe that at the time you also had a thesis for crypto, right? Yes. What evolved, not to say you still don't believe in crypto, but what evolved when you said, okay, I'm going to now go launch RiseFest? And you didn't lead with crypto with the, what was the distinction between saying, okay, these are traditional ways of investing. Crypto is obviously much more volatile. What was your thinking around that?
Yeah. When we started Bitcoins, we quickly understood that the market for crypto is about 8% of the population, while the vast majority, almost like 40% of the population, demanded more traditional investment. So, you know, that was an easy math to do. Secondly, there was a perception thing with crypto where it was still early. People thought it was a scam.
Yep.
You know, so it's harder to build trust in that space. But where we started now, I think we've built enough base that over the next year or two, we might start to venture back into some crypto related stuff.
And I want to talk a little bit more about inheritance, right? And I feel like a lot of people, when we talk about investing, we only talk about it from the African context. Okay, I'm investing, I'm putting money into something. But why haven't we been able to build consistent generational wealth? Like, what do you see?
Great question. That's a fact. That's an episode of its own.
Well, we have some time.
Yeah, we have some time.
Because, I think that, when I said we would rise that, you know, if you do rise properly, you should be able to, you know, live off the outcome of your investments.
Exactly.
And then leave something for, you know, the people coming behind you. The truth is that one of our goals is to make that thought process mainstream, right? It's not yet mainstream. I think the mainstream thinking right now is that, you know what, during my working years, I take care of my children, I raise them, and then in the twilight of my years, they look after me and take care of me. And so that generational sense that I need to make enough to leave something behind, the people who have done it have been a combination of, they just made so much that there was no way they could, you know, spend it all in their lifetime. And so they left something for the kids, or people who have been incredibly like insightful and had like the ability to plan, which is not majority of our people. Right. So, but besides this, I think that we have to also look at the context of Africa and Nigeria. Wealth creation has not also lasted that long consistently, right? So you make wealth in some active years and it's destroyed by one policy or the other, or you put it in some assets and their value gets destroyed. So the instability of the country and the continent has also impacted like succession and stability of wealth. Wealth grows in environments where there's stability, right? And because we've not had that, we've not evolved to pass on wealth consistently. That's the bad part. The good part is that it's starting to change, right? Access to the global space and global economy means that now people are getting used to having trust funds, right? People are starting to think about offshore investments. It's becoming more mainstream to know that there is a sense of continuity where I create a trust. When I pass on, my children will continue. Corporate governance. So a lot of our businesses used to be that the founders or the early key people, once they are gone, that's it, right? Maybe from 1990, you start to see more institutionalized businesses, but that's still nascent. So it's a very complex conversation, but I think that where we are today, I mean, we're starting to make more progress than in the past, where more people are aware of it. And awareness, like they say, is always the first step. So the solutions are starting to come out. And hopefully we'll see a better sense of continuity and inheritance or succession planning when it comes to wealth management in our space.
And actually, I have a deeper thing I want to get into with inheritance, because I've seen this a lot, specifically with women. Right.
Absolutely.
We were looking at something around a story of a woman who built wealth with her husband for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
He dies. They remove the wealth from her. Can you talk about that? What is going on, and how can women protect their investments? Because I hear that is half of the problem is
yes.
that the man who, you know, was the head of the household, but maybe together they were building wealth. There was no plan put in place, no will. And then even if there was, it's not actually looked at. Like the core, a lot of times is right. like, well, what is that?
I'll be a little, in fact, can I be a little controversial?
Yeah, no, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Don't trust African culture to protect that specific area of your interest as a woman, because the culture itself is still learning how to have those conversations, right? So for instance, yeah, we jointly built this wealth, husband and wife. African culture is still seeing that as primarily, well, is the man's, you know, belongs to the man. The family is the, so the idea that no, this is a joint thing is just starting to take roots. So we've not gotten to the point where we now have systems to protect. And there are some cultures where, oh, you own something. If it's in your name, nobody cares. But when it's a joint thing, that is still very early. So what I've seen, and I had a conversation with the king of my and HA's village where we're talking about this specific issue, right? That a man and a woman get a property together, there's a tendency to just default it to the man. We have to account for the fact that these are husband and wife. They own this jointly. Therefore, if one of them is no longer there, so see that thing where they say like there's a survivorship thing in joint ownership. Mm-hmm. The remaining owner becomes the sole owner. Our culture needs to update that. We need to know that if a man and a woman own property together, even if it's not explicitly in their name, written like, but that's his wife, right? Anything that the man leaves behind, it should just become the default. That's a longer thing. That's a bigger conversation, but I think it's important. But from a practical level not the cultural aspect, just a practical level, I think that formalizing things is important. So have your name in the legal documents, have a lawyer, have your signature on the will or the trust. Make sure that, you know, there's a document that accounts for survivorship, literally written down saying, if one of us is no longer there, this person is the person in charge, and have it written in black and white and signed. Because the good thing is that the law actually protects the woman in situations where there's a written agreement, a written document, or her name is on the dock. But when you're looking at what we default to as Africans, then there's a lot to unpack there, because I don't think the current reality is very fair. But again, I'm hopeful, and the conversations are starting, that every generation is different. And so our generation, I think our responsibility is to make sure that this awareness becomes, you know, normalized, that, you know, men and women, should have an equal say in how their joint property is treated in the absence of either one. There shouldn't be this bias towards men.
And can you actually demystify the will as well, right? Because mm-hmm. I've spoken to a lot of people who come from wealth. And what always ends up happening, if you look at, you know, from the Nigerian context, there's the grandfather, grandmother, right? And then there's the husband, wife, and then there's the kids, right? And the kids are always in this situation where the person died, and I don't know if there was a will, there was kind of a will, and then they're in court. And they're just in court for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. Why is that consistently happening? Why have we not shifted the culture into actually having it all documented?
Let me even add to that before mm-hmm. you answer, because we were at Federal Palace, right? Yeah. And I think obviously it was owned by the Hebrews and stuff. But this is a story that we've talked about this, where from Abriba, like it's across a lot of Igbo families, a lot of Yoruba families, a lot of even Hausa families, right? Mm-hmm. Why is this a consistent theme, and why is it the patriarch don't learn from all the other mistakes that everybody else has made, and everybody ends up in court? What is going on?
So the court bits, I think wills is very easy. It's fairly easy to contest wills in Nigeria, right? And again, anything that ends up in court is just a recipe for it to take forever, right? One of my uncles, and I also want to point this out personally, and I'm saying this as my personal view. I don't mean to attack anybody, but I personally think that polygamy is a major contributor to some of these succession problems, right? I just don't think it's very compatible with sustainable wealth transfer, because families are almost already divided into factions by the mere fact that it's polygamous in nature. So I've made that point privately, and I'm also making it publicly now, that I'm not the biggest fan of polygamy. Again, I understand if that's some people's choices. I'm not speaking against that. But in the context of wealth transfer, it leads to a lot of problems. But then beyond that, I think there's this sense where, or some of the reason these disputes come up is that sometimes the patriarchs themselves, you know, you create a will, yes. But sometimes you find out that nobody else in the family is aware of the will, of the process, you know, even aside the will, there has to be a process. This is the trustee or this is the custodian of the will. This is what happens after I die. Reach out to this person. So you're supposed to prepare. And some patriarchs, some, again, I'm being careful, but some patriarchs sometimes are intentional about not making the process very obvious because they want to retain some cards, or they want to play some politics or favorites. You know, they let some people in, or they tell some people this and they tell someone else something else. But I think that one is a cultural education thing that people need to understand that besides, once you're at a certain level of wealth, you're no longer just an individual with money to spend. There's an institution that you represent something, and the families that get it right start early to treat their family and their wealth as an institution, something that has to be managed professionally, laid out with processes. So when you see families like that, it might feel like they're doing too much. But when you find that when there's time for succession, it's well laid out. There's structures. There's everyone knows what's happening. You know, that's the way, same way companies operate. I think at certain levels of wealth, people need to start to think of themselves as companies and actually create proper structures that allow wealth transfers to happen or generational wealth transfers to happen. And again, we're learning it, but I think it needs to get to the mainstream.
You know, I was watching, I read something from Warren Buffett. And he was saying that his views on wills and even family succession has evolved over time. And he said, you know, what he's done now is, you know, sometimes people do the thing where they might make a video mm-hmm. and then maybe it's played after their death. Mm-hmm. But then your survivors will still contest it and say, oh, that was not his thing.
His best mind, right?
And then some people maybe even still let them know that there's a will, but they will still even end up contesting mm-hmm. it. And he said what he then realized was the best thing to do is actually read the will out to all your people gathered and then let them know these are your wishes, right? Mm. But then if they also have feedback, because some of the times is you yourself as the person who's making the yes. will might lack context.
Right.
If they give you that feedback in person, you can then say, oh, that's a good point. I will then change this. But all of us here know this is why I'm changing
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And I think there was something he said, because I think so many times people are so uncomfortable with talking about death and succession planning, especially mm-hmm, in our context mm-hmm, as mm-hmm, Africans, like, mm-hmm. make they no go use juju on me, make they no go plan something. Yep, make they no, yep, how yep. many times do our parents say, yep. oh, don't eat at this person's house, don't do this?
We're a low-trust society.
We're a low-trust society, right? But that the idea he was saying is it takes courage to actually be able to do that and sit the people you love down and say, these are my wishes. What do you think? Mm-hmm. And then if I take your feedback mm-hmm. on, you guys know that this is final, so that after my death, my legacy, and I think that's the thing that really troubles me so much is, you as the patriarch, you made this wealth because you wanted your people to be good after. But then it becomes the very thing that destroys
Absolutely.
Your legacy. So if that's the thinking, especially like, we talk about it from an Abiba context. Mm-hmm. Like we've seen it across the board. We've seen it in the Igbo sector. We've seen it just across Africa, right? When do you think, like, and what are the tools? I mean, you've already touched on a couple of it, but what are the tools even more patriarchs need to start, you know, imbibing
Wait,
to?
Why just patriarchs?
Patriarchs, well, patriarchs, matriarchs, same
and
thing.
And matriarchs.
No, the funny thing, the funny thing,
everybody's actually a matrilineal society,
okay, so
patriarchs is matrilineal. So, okay, matriarchs, patriarchs.
Yes.
A bengal,
femco. Yeah, let's clarify so people don't think that, oh,
only the patriarchs.
Only patriarchs.
Right, no, absolutely. So, H.A.'s granddad is a textbook case of this, right? In our village, like, his family was so wealthy that they became a benchmark. I think at some point they were the wealthiest family in our town. And then the next generation sort of, you started to see the fractures happen, but then it didn't get to the third generation.
It definitely didn't get to me, in case anybody's watching. Hey, you can't build me up.
The third generation, the lifestyle got to them. Right.
It's not a real life.
Guys, make them look up Bill Bill. I don't want to see trust you. I'm doing well. Please, it did not reach my side.
You guys inherited the lifestyle.
Like
learned how this is what the family
aesthetic,
behaviors.
Aesthetic,
yeah,
aesthetic,
but, behaviors.
But the wealth, and again, there's more. That one is a big one, but there's multiple stories like this. And to be fair, I don't know exactly what the answer is, right? Because what I said about the fact that we're a low trust society, right? It's hard enough, even professionally, it's hard enough to get people to open up about their money, right? Everyone kind of plays it very close to their chest, yeah. You know. But I think what I always try to say is the people, if I look at the success stories and then ask myself, what did these people who are success stories, what did they get right? And I find that it's what you said about openness, right? Families where there's openness and people are able to just talk. So I encourage people, talk to your family about your wealth, right? I think Ire Aderoko mentioned something, and I hope she doesn't mind. It's not something that crazy, but I think she said that by the time she was getting older, right, their parents very intentionally like give them a sense of, listen, this is what we do as a family, right? This is what we do. This is how we make money. This is what we own, right? And in a way that is not like braggadocio, right? Yeah. It's much more like we want you to understand so that when you know that money does not just show up, right? You do certain things, and to anybody, you can make yours. You have to learn, you develop your skills, develop yourself so you don't also think of money, oh, this is something we own and therefore it doesn't matter what I do, the money will be there. So I think that it starts from there. It starts from being more open about financial conversations. And if someone's listening, I think that's a good place to start. I think the next thing aside of that is also the way we educate. I think there's some changes that needs to happen in terms of how we educate our children. In Igbo society, which I can speak to, right, you find that a lot of parents, this is what they're doing to make money, but they are training their children and pushing them to anything but whatever it is, yep, that they do, right? So, and I think that needs to change, because if you've already identified a good opportunity, economic opportunity, trust me, there are not that many. So if you find one that's working, it can only be improved by someone more educated handling it. So the families that have succeeded took their educated child, went to some of the best schools, brought them into the business, and allowed them to sort of contribute that education into the next generation so that it might not look exactly like what you started off with. I think a good example is the story of GIGM, right? God is Good Motors was started by their father, who I'm not sure what his education level is, but at least he did the business sort of the old school way. And then his son took over. He had the education, he had the exposure. But then when he took over, he brought in all the context he has built up from being well-educated to evolve the business. And that evolution allowed them to become GIGM, become GIGL, have some other sections of the business. And everybody in the family is also contributing. They are responsible for different things. So I think education matters, but also how that education happens and giving children exposure. You cannot take someone who has never been exposed to the business, never been exposed to how the family makes money, and then one day you just say, hey, sit down here, you're now in charge, and expect it to go well, right? So I think that those are the two main areas I feel we should do differently. Be more open about financial conversations. It's not just, oh, daddy makes money, that's it. Tell them how. And secondly, when you're educating your children, also expose them to the business and allow them to understand it intimately so that one day when they start making decisions, they will be able to take it into the next generation.
So the Naira has depreciated almost 95% against the dollar, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a future in which African currencies are going to be stable enough for long-term wealth building, or is dollar hedging permanent? But before you also answer that, I remember thinking, obviously, most Africans think dollar hedging. Like, we're always thinking dollar. Right. But as somebody who's also lived in the U.S. or lives in the U.S., I'm also there and looking at, I'm like, this dollar itself is trending. it needs to be hedged against, too, right? And so I remember trying to explain that to, I think it was my dad. I was like, people in Nigeria see the dollar as the safest haven, mm-hmm, which is understood given the context. But there are people in America who are like, this dollar is no longer safe. Yeah. So we need to figure out another hedge. Mm-hmm. But these are two separate questions.
Right.
African currencies, would they be stable enough? And also, can you touch on the fact that the dollar itself is no longer as stable?
As stable. Great question. Yeah. So, in investing, they tell you is sort of a game of predicting the future, but in a limited sense. I think that for the foreseeable future, dollar hedging is almost always going to be here. And again, just because of the gap in productivity between the average African economy and the U.S., right? So from that lens, if you look at inflation in the U.S., it's about 2.5%. On average in Africa, the lowest is about 5%, and ours is trending in the right direction, finally, but it's still like double digits. So just off of that comparison, you know that for an African, being in dollars is always going to be a good idea. And a lot of our economies also are import dependent. So being exposed to dollar also makes sense from your own purchasing power. So I think for now, it's still, again, 10 years. Who knows what will happen after 10 years? But at least for the next decade, it's still going to be a thing, right? And then for the US side, it's more interesting, more nuanced, right? Some people have said, oh, you know, there's a lot of other currencies challenging the dollar. And when you look at the actual facts, or you look beyond the headlines and look at the numbers, dollar dominance is still stable and in some cases growing, right? Stable coins has been like a boon. Like Uncle Sam is going to be happy that someone invented stable coins because it's extended the reach of the dollar globally. But also there are things like gold, like that have become a hedge to the dollar. Some people talk about Bitcoin as a hedge to the dollar. Swiss francs, maybe. But I think those three are the most likely candidates for hedge to the dollar. So because there's stability, there's on the Bitcoin side, there's supply constraints. On Swiss side, there's the political realities. And then gold side, there's the demand from emerging markets. So I feel like if you're in a market where you're primarily thinking in dollars, I'm always going to preach diversification, right? Have some Bitcoin, have some gold, but you're probably always going to need the dollar. And if you're in Africa, have some dollars, but also have investments in Naira, in Kenyan shillings, in Ghanaian cedis, because you still live here. So it's almost not about just a specific currency. It's about diversifying across multiple currencies or multiple assets, but also making sure that you're earning the best returns and you're making the optimal decision for wherever it is that you live. That's how I think about it.
You were one of the first Nigerian founders who were in YC, right? Yes. What were some of the things you... First of all, can you talk about how great YC is for a founder, and what were some of the things you had to unlearn, and what did YC open your eyes to as well?
And also, sorry, to clarify, because our audience may not know what that is. So it's Y Combinator.
Accelerator.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So Y Combinator was an interesting experience. Shout out to them. So when we got in,
What year was that?
That was in 2018. So the summer of 2018, with Bitcoins, right? I think when we got it, again, I was coming off of the finance consulting industry. Timmy has been a programmer area as well. So I can say for me, the biggest transition is that going from a space in consulting where it's about how smart you are, the quality of your opinions, how well informed they are, your expertise. YC is like, scratch all that, right? When you're building technology, when you're building for customers or tech products, it's not about how smart you are. It's not about the quality of your opinions. It's about how well you understand the customer, right? So YC is just like, build what people want. That's their thing. But it sounds deceptively simple. But a lot of times people build what they think people want.
Yes.
Right. Or they build what they want.
Exactly.
Right. And then they force the market to buy it. Or they think, oh, they build what sometimes your investors want. But YC tells you that there's one habit I picked up at YC. Every day for 3 months that we're doing YC, the only thing they told us is every single day you call at least 10 to 15 customers, take notes of all the feedback they give you, and then go build that. Tomorrow, you do it again. And it's shockingly simple, but if you can do this consistently in the right market, you'll be surprised how far you go, right? So I think that was the biggest sort of like mind light bulb, right, that YC gave me. Another thing is just how malleable the world is, right? So a bank will tell us, oh, we can't open a bank account for you guys. You know, you don't have this and this and this. And YSO tell us, okay, so what are you going to do? I'm like, they've said that, you know, they're not, it's like, okay, so what? Are you going to just, that's it? No. So what are you going to do? We kept one of those cases, we kept looking around for a bank and we finally found a bank. All the banks in San Francisco said no to us. And then YC is like, well, there are other banks in other parts of the country. So we kept searching online. And finally, the bank in South Carolina was like, oh yeah, we'll set up a, cause it was crypto. Banks were running away from crypto. I'm like, oh, we'll set up an account for you guys, but you have to sign and fill out everything in person, right? So we now came to them and we're like, oh, well, we're in San Francisco. They're saying, it's like, so what are you doing here? Go. So we flew 8 hours, filled out the bank. And again, I'm Nigerian. You don't book a flight and go somewhere really far, pay a lot of money just to sign one documents form and fly back, right? We don't do that. Like, come on, you have to have a better reason than that. But YC is like, if you're trying to win, don't be afraid to like do whatever is necessary. It might look stupid to someone externally, it might look wasteful, but as long as it moves you in the direction of your goal, right? Yeah. Then that's what you have to do. So it's in YC that I learned, okay, I need to close a customer and the customer is spending a lot of time making their decision because we're online. I'll fly to Lagos, show up, close the deal, fly back, right? And that it does something to you. You know, like paying a lawyer $15,000, which we did, was again, another crazy. I'm like, this thing you can do it for, but it'll tell you, there's a reason these people do. And when you're raising and you start to deal with all the nuances of the paperwork, you don't realize, oh, there's a reason these guys are worth this much. So there were so many things I had to unlearn around how to think about even money, how to think about what is doable and how not to accept that, oh, this can be done. That's it. Now, there's always a way to do it. You just haven't found it yet. So those are some of the takeaways that YC gave me.
What about from a hiring perspective? Because I think as founders ourselves, I tell people, like, one of the things I know a lot of founders I see on the index on completely is talent. I don't know if it's a thing because of our market, but in San Francisco, they value talent. Like, you're literally treated like a football star or a basketball star, right? Like, this is supreme talent. We will move haystacks to get to you.
Right.
What were some of the things you had to learn about hiring? And also, what are some of the things you pass on to the team now and advice you give to founders around talent?
Yeah, I think this is one area where my own learning is still happening, to be fair, because the mindset of, you know, you build your talent internally, you help them, you groom your talent is something that we're still trying to shake off, right? Because sometimes it takes too long, right? And San Francisco, they'll you know, find someone that is already very good at what you're doing, give them whatever they're asking for. I think that as African startups, I think we understand this from a head level, but we're still very, there's this thing where you kind of have to manage your money, put it like that, right? We can't just blow money quickly because we'll raise another round. As Africans, we have to sort of figure out how to quote unquote make do. But as you get bigger and as you start to grow, you start to get to points where you cannot groom this talent in-house. You have to go out for it, right? And when you go out for it, you have to pay what it's necessary. So I think it's stage dependent. I think that's where we are now, where as we're starting to scale, you know, I'm bringing in people who, many of them, they are making more than I'm making, right? But when you see them come in and really unlock the next stage of value, again, it creates that shift in you. And as a founder, I tell people that every 6 months to a year, I look back at how I used to think and I realize that there's been a sea change in my perspective, right? And that's part of the journey of a founder. You sort of just learn and you have to update your thinking constantly. So now I'm really at that point where, listen, if you're extremely good at something, you're among the 1% at it, and I'll bring you on board. If I can afford it, I'll bring you on board because I know you're going to unlock something for me that will compensate for whatever it is that I'm paying you. So that's kind of the journey that I'm getting into at this stage.
And speaking of talent, so a lot of that talent is Japa, right? They're going, they're disappearing, they're going in droves. So I want you to talk about, if you were talking to your 25-year-old self, what would you say to someone who's planning to leave because they feel like there's no future here?
Honestly, leave. No, seriously. Like, because again, 25-year-old me was in the US, right? Yeah. So I wouldn't even have any moral standing to tell someone, don't leave when I'm cruising on the freeway on my way to Houston, right? So I think that's always a good idea. Leave, but then come back, right? And I say that because even before the current climate that is becoming a bit hostile to our people, or to immigrants in general, I think that I've always known intuitively that no one knows this market like we do, right? And again, when it comes to business, it's usually deep insights, deep understanding of a market that allows you to create value, right? So I can never know the U.S. the way someone who was born and raised in the U.S. knows it. No matter how long I lived, well, maybe at some point, maybe, but it would take me a lot of time, right? But I know Nigeria. So I can travel, learn a lot and all, but it's time to create value, I think it makes sense to come back and create that value here. So it's not as easy for most people to do, but I think if you can, leave, because when you leave, you learn a lot. You get exposed to other ideas. There's so much that happens around the world that people don't really understand, or until they've experienced it, then they can't contextualize it, right? But once you've learned enough and you've gotten enough exposure and built up some resources, I think the next best move is to come back home. Mm. So that's how I think about Jakba.
And it's interesting you speak about this, because I reflect on my journey. So I was in 500 startups in 2017, nice, right? Nice. And I remember, learned a lot. I came back and I felt like all these things they taught me, yes, some of them were quite valuable, but I have to throw that out the window because mm-hmm. I have to adapt to the Nigerian market, right?
Absolutely.
When it comes to building tech. And so I want you to speak to that entrepreneur, right? That has said, I've come back to Nigeria. Maybe I schooled abroad. I want to build something. I'm excited. Like, talk to them about really adapting to this market.
Okay.
So
Let me tell you a story. I have several stories.
Please share. Please share.
So when I first came back in 2017, I got off the plane at 5 a.m. and the weather was hot, like crazy hot. And I'm like, why is this hot at 5 a.m.? And then my brother came to pick me up. We drove into the road and it was an explosion of chaos. Like, I haven't been back, maybe by then, I hadn't been back for like 5-6 years. So we stepped into the road and the only thing, the analogy that I can use is, you remember like this, when you were playing brick game, mm-hmm. there's this one where you had to like keep jumping across mm-hmm. a road, and because there's just so many things flying at you. That's how it felt being in Nigeria after 6 years. There's no lane markers. There's no traffic sign. It's just road and everybody's mm-hmm. in it. And that was wild. But after like a while, I got used to it enough, right? So I saw certain things here that I was just, I don't know how people do this. But what I'll tell people is, you know, when you come in, after that shock, I guess I didn't have to. I remember telling my brother the next day, I'm going to take your car and just go drive around, right? So I just drove around Ojolegba, drove around Yaba, drove around Surulere. And I'm just like, okay, this place is crazy, but I think I get it. Like, I understand how to move with that craziness. So you just have to find that part of you that can handle chaos and then try and make something out of it. But to be more specific, just reduce your expectations to zero. Nothing works the way it works everywhere else. That's it. Just know what you see. There's someone's Twitter bio that says, well, this is Nigeria. Anything you see, just take it like that. That's my recommendation. Just take whatever you see, just take it like that. But on a more serious note, you have to be very clear on what you're trying to achieve, right? On what you're trying to do. Because Nigeria, for all its faults and all its chaos, Nigeria does bend to the person who has clarity of vision, right? And I think Africa as a whole, if you have clarity of vision, everybody might not get along with it, but the few people that do,
yeah.
will unlock so many things, yeah. right? So I find that the people who struggle tend to be people who come back without a clear sense of what they want to do. So they just go with the flow. They just, and you find out that you're going with the flow that a year, 2 years, 3 years, nothing has happened. But if you have a very clear sense of this is what I'm trying to do, no matter how big or small it is, it doesn't matter. Even if you want to say, I want to come in and create a new place for people to braid hair different from everybody else, just go lock in on that. Even if you don't make the most amount of money, you create enough presence that you become a reference point for this is where to go to do this, or this is how to do this. So that's what I tell people. Have a very, very clear vision. Be stubborn about it. Be willing to go crazy about it. But aside that, I mean, just don't have too many expectations, because this place to me is the upside down. Not to be politically correct, it is crazy. But it's also very worth it. I don't know if your experience matches, but I think that working here for a few years, you'll find out that you might have a trade-off where I could have made more money in the US, but I have a lot more fulfillment knowing the impact of the work I'm doing here.
So that's how I
think about it.
It's funny you say that, because number one, you're right, right? Like if I just maybe stayed as a consultant, who knows, right? After Georgetown. But then I also say, whenever I see that Forbes billionaire list, right? Yes. The top black people, black. Now we're not talking about always Nigerians,
Absolutely.
Right? And they're making their wealth right here.
Absolutely.
So at the end of the day, I'm like, yeah, but the if I want to achieve a certain level of success, then it's like a long-term game as well. Mm-hmm. And speaking about that, because you mentioned a company, GIG, right? Is there other like family or type case studies where you can talk about where maybe it started with one person and then they passed on and built it? Because I feel like there's all these like interesting companies in Nigeria, but nobody talks about them. And a lot of times I'll ask the question like, oh, it was started by this person. Now the son runs it, or now the daughter runs it. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So, I think you're right that it's, even off the top of my head, I can't think of that many. I know a good, so there's been, you know, so let's say Pascal Dozier with Diamond Bank. I know that all the Dozier kids are currently in the financial sector in one way or the other, but they're not necessarily running Diamond Bank. But if you see what they're doing, you can tell that there's definitely a cross-pollination of DNA in that sense, right? Like they've seen this firsthand, so they know how to move. I see a lot more of that than the more traditional, you know, this company, you step down and the company continues. So GIGM is one of the cases where I've just seen a direct succession. I have a couple others where they're not well-known companies as much, but I think, there's a friend of mine, Okechukwu, his dad had like a wine importation business, and then he came in and he diversified. They started doing like local manufacturing for tomatoes and some mining related stuff. And the company has grown, but I can't really say it's the same thing that what his dad was doing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very tricky thing. And, like I see more recently the Eleganza kid on social tapping into like a new audience, creating plastic glasses, continuing that legacy. But I don't think he's the one in charge of the organization right now. So there's much more instances where kids come in, sort of see what their dad or their mom or someone that came before them did. And then they kind of like build their own niche within that space. Another good example, I don't remember her name now, but the lady that owns Rough and Tumble.
Oh yes.
I know like at least one of her kids, is doing something fashion related. But again, it doesn't look like what the mom did, but you can see that. Oh, I've seen my parents do this, and therefore I'm applying. Yeah, so that's what I see the more of, and I don't know. Hopefully, we'll see much more direct succession in our era.
So the diaspora sends home about $95 billion to Africa yearly, right? About 6% of it only goes to investment. What would it take to shift or make at least 10% of it go towards investment versus consumption? I think I had a post on LinkedIn that really spoke to this. It was going viral on WhatsApp chats. And you know, and it's like this whole thing where we will consume, we will build the village in the house.
Right.
We'll build the house in the village. We will spend money on a lot of the jaya stuff. But when it comes to actually investing in some of the infrastructure or even Aba, there's a story that my aunt was telling me about the road in Aba, but this is neither here or there. But these are like examples of like, why aren't we shifting a lot more of these things towards investment versus consumption?
Yeah. You know, I used to worry about this as well. And I think, again, because of the work we do, I try to spend a lot of time to answer this question. And we have something that we're currently working on in this space. Asset-based, we're trying to leverage our licensed presence in the US and Nigeria to try and create a structure that will allow people to invest at home seamlessly. But besides that, I try to answer the question of why don't people already do this? Because the investment needs are clear. The opportunity is there. But having been here a few years, I found that it's still down to trust,
yes,
right? And people underestimate how fundamental trust is to wealth building. Low trust societies will always struggle to build wealth because what is wealth if not just, you know, it's trust, institutionalized trust. So you find that people want to invest, but they're like, if I put in this investment, like consumption is, I don't have to trust anybody. I know when my house is there. I know when I've drank my champagne.
My Hennessy.
I know when I've bought my flashy car and, you know, come back in December, I have the time. Like, it doesn't require any trust. But once you want to do investments, then you need to trust the people operating it. You need to have a sense that, and also the environment has to incentivize long-term investments, right? So I'm not trying to put in money 6 months from there, I'll take it out. If you're asking diaspora to invest, you're asking them to trust that the country will be stable, the environment will be stable, that the people operating these investments will do what they're supposed to do, that there's legal enforcement for times when things go wrong. And if all these things are not being attended to, then the real question is, does it shock anyone that people are not pushing funds toward investments? Because you have no, there's not enough reasons to deploy an investment into a space where you're not physically there. The people that you want to do it might not do what you agree. There's no legal recourse for you. So it feels like throwing away money. And so if it's better for me to use that money and pop champagne and know that at least I've flexed it, right? So that's what I think is going on. But again, hopefully I think that the solutions that we have in mind, and I was telling you that I spoke to IKSA about some things I want to do, because it becomes about how do you create structures that allow trust to happen at scale? And if you answer that question, then maybe we can become a vector, a vehicle that allow investments to start to come in from the diaspora.
That channels that. What is the one mindset that unlocks everything? Like, what do people need to believe differently about money, wealth, and their own agency?
Ah, that's a good question. I think that there's several counterintuitive beliefs that I have when it comes to money. One is when we talk about delayed gratification a lot, but I think it's much more like long-term thinking, right? So if I think about myself in the future as important as myself today, right? So I'm 36 now. I know that 10 years from today, I'll be 46. What am I doing today to make sure that 46-year-old me will be happy with the time that passed, right? And the choices that I've... So people over-index on their present reality and not enough on their long-term reality. I think that's one unlock. Always be thinking about the next decade, about the next 2 decades, because everyone overestimates, there's that saying that people overestimate what is possible in 1 year, but they vastly underestimate what is possible in 10 years.
Yeah.
So if you start to think in decades, that's one major unlock. I think another unlock when it comes to money is that focus on creating value, right? Focus on creating value. If you can create, the more value you create for others, right? The more value you create for the world around you, the more value will come to you, right? So think about when instead of thinking, oh, how can I make money or how can I earn more money? What you should be asking constantly is, wherever it is that I am today, am I creating enough value and how can I create much more value than I'm creating right now, which then speaks also to agency. When you talk about agency, the world today, and we had this conversation during my company retreats last weekend, and people were asking, you know, how do you accelerate your career growth or whatever? And I'm like, there's so many problems that need to be solved, both within the company at any given time and also the world around us. But there's not enough people who are willing to just say, oh, it's not this other person's responsibility. Like, instead of saying, oh, why can't they do something about it? Ask yourself, what can I do? Mm. People that take that inward sense that say, if something is going on, it's my responsibility to do something about it, and then actually go ahead and do it, they rise up within an organization this fast. Money flows to them this. So we have this culture of learned helplessness where we say, well, they're not doing this. It's always they, you know. And when I remember when I was young, again, I used to be an excuse maker in some cases. Oh, they didn't tell us this. And then my mom would ask me, who are they? Who's that? Who's they? So I think the points were, and I don't remember when I learned this, but there was a book or something I read that just said, if you assume that any problem you encounter is your responsibility to fix,
yeah,
you will get much farther than if you keep looking for someone else to pass that responsibility off. And so once I internalized that, I started to realize that, oh, all these problems that exist are just opportunities for me to do something. And the more you become the problem solver again, the more money will flow to you. So those are the mindset shifts that I think would help.
Okay, so before we transition to our rapid fire segment, I think the other question I wanted to ask you, and this is from a founder's perspective,
yeah,
99 or 95% of startups fail, right? You have been in this journey long enough to see people you started off with, you know, either round off their companies or like founders just, you know, move on to the next thing. As a founder yourself, how do you maintain the tension between, almost today we're alive, or today we feed Dio, almost today we're alive, or today we feed Dio, and when you're also seeing other people around you navigate? Because I think another thing about African culture is we don't handle failure well.
Yes.
Like so many founders I know, their startups have actually like rounded up, but they've still not even come to terms with it, regardless of even telling the world that, hey, this is now wrapped up. So what is that tension like, and how can you explain to people who are watching, who want to be founders? Because I think we've glorified being founders as something to aspire to, what the true cost of being a founder really is, and what has it cost you?
Pain and suffering, my brother. Pain and suffering. I'm only half joking when I say that. I think that, in a way, founders are almost like a personality type, right? And it's that you're so locked in on trying to create something that you're willing to endure the suffering that it takes to make that happen. Because, yeah, it's really not easy. And I think by this time, at this point, this might be a cliche. It's really, really tough. It's really, and mentally, it's where all the pain happens, is mentally. So I feel like it helps to go in with the mindset that, you know, whatever happens, I don't even want to say, oh, if it fails, like reconcile yourself with it, because I don't think that's a good idea. I think that you should go in with the mindset of you have no alternative except to succeed, right? Just burn the ships and just, either I win or I die.
We drown, yeah.
Right. But at the same time, it's that thing they say about strong opinions loosely held. Understand that if for any reason you find yourself at the point where it's not working and you know that you have to throw in the towel, do that with the understanding that the effort alone and the fact if you gave it your best effort and you did everything within your power, because you might not do everything possible, but you did the ones that are within your power and it didn't work out, that's okay. You're just a person, right? So it happens. And it requires mental toughness even to do, and a certain level of shamelessness, right? Because whether you succeed or fail, I mean, people will drag GB, who is evidently quite successful at something extremely difficult. They will also drag Ezra. Right? They drag both the winners and the losers. Yeah. There's no, you will get dragged one way or the other, right? So the point is just get to a point where you don't care as much about what people say. If you're someone as a founder who is who's externally validated, or I don't know the right way, but if you derive your validation from external source, don't be a founder, because that's not, it's not a good journey for you
at all.
You want to be someone that is internally driven, right? So you know that, you know your internal compass, you know you give it your best. If you succeed, that's wonderful. If you fail, you know, you did what you had to do and you move on to the next. It's not the end of the world. That's how I think about that.
You know, it's funny, as you were talking, I was just thinking about the whole Japanese act of seppuku. Like,
right.
Where it's when you've gone to the point where you burned the ships,
yes,
you did everything you could, it's time to now have an honorable death, obviously, figuratively. Yes.
Right.
And I think sometimes it's the delayed seppuku that annoys me.
Yes.
Where it's like, you don't know, you need to kill this thing so you can resurrect.
So you can go to, yes, exactly. Absolutely.
And so for founders watching, it's like, you need to have some level of self-awareness where it's like, look, we tried everything. It's not working. It's time to connect, to commit seppuku in a way that honors this process.
Yes.
And then resurrect it as a phoenix for your next venture.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And I also find that when people are holding on to something that is obviously not working, and you see it in so many ways. So in some cases, there's a germ of an idea there, but you need to switch approaches, or you need to pivot. But then they keep holding on. Sometimes this thing is hopeless, but you just keep pushing it. Most of the time, it's usually because they are trying to live up to some external expectation, right? Internally, the only thing that should keep you going is because when you listen to your inner mind, you know there's still something there. The moment you yourself know that there's nothing there anymore, do the right thing by yourself and just, you know, let it go. Okay. So, yeah, it still boils down to that, having an internal compass, because external people, you can never please them all. So,
okay, so we're going to transition to, you had one more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I wanted to circle into this, because you brought up a past guest, Ike Eze, right?
Right.
And you talked about the conversation around investing in Southeast. Can you talk a little bit about that, like insights into that?
Yeah. So we found that we're talking, I brought the conversation to him anyway. So we met at a conference in Enugu in May, and they were trying to talk about how to grow the tech ecosystem in Enugu, which then opened me up to a conversation with a lot of the players in that ecosystem. And I wrote a post on Medium about the culture, the startup culture in the Southeast, and some of the deficiencies that I noticed, but also some of the opportunities that I noticed. And so because he's an institutional investor, I went to him to then say, hey, I look at this market. There's opportunity here, but there's also these challenges. And what's the best way to unlock the value in the Southeast? And so to his credit, he said, yeah, that he's also been asking himself the same question, and they've thought around it a little bit. And what we landed on after a little bit of back and forth is that we need to figure out a different model where because they are a lot earlier in the curve, in the technology adoption curve, what we need to do is to find, the early sparks, the guys that have like some early potential, and then creates a vehicle that invests in many of them at once, almost like a mini YC style thing, where there will be some losers, but the few key, because again, ecosystems are built on the back of successful companies, right? On the back of the winners. So the game is, how do you find the winners? What's a low cost way, and something that doesn't require to spend a lot of time and a lot of money, but cast a wide net, figure out the winners, and then give them stronger backing. So that's where our conversation got. So we're exploring something where, some kind of vehicle, again, with other partners or other investors potentially. Again, I just came in as I'm a founder. I think there are other founders here. It's not like my money is that long, but we have, you know, maybe asset base where we can give people opportunities to invest in them. But what is the best vehicle? So him as an investor, again, providing that expertise, said, oh, the best way is to create a vehicle that allows us to cast a wide net. And then as we cast that net, we find the guys that have potential. And if they do well, rise above the surface, then we can connect them to more capital and more opportunities to start that growth curve. So it's something I'm actually excited and looking forward to.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
So babes, I'm always talking to you about investing. How's your journey going so far?
It started because you've been on my head for the past 6 months about investing, and you'll be proud of me because I actually found an app I love. It's called RiseVest. And actually what I love about it is that you can start with $10 and it automates everything for you. So literally I just go into the app and literally it's investing for me every single day.
Yeah, because we know you're not going to be a trader anytime soon. But with RiseVest, you're going to be able to invest in US stocks, right? Fixed income, real estate, etc., right? And so I'm happy you're finally on board.
And you know, the funny thing too is I always tell my girls that as women, we're not investing enough, we're not talking about it, and we're not having these conversations. So I shared it in all my group chats. So you can find RiseVest on the Apple and Google Play Store.
Okay, make sure to use code Afropolitan so that they know that we sent you. You know how every week we sit down with people who've done it, people who've built, people who've led movements, people who've created culture. What if you could do more than just listen to them? That is why we built Convo by Afropolitan. On Convo, you're able to book one-on-one video calls with in-demand experts from Africa and the diaspora. Go to convo.vip to get access to your next mentor, because sometimes one convo can change your entire path. So we're going to transition to our rapid fire segment, okay, where we ask you your first question. The first thought that comes into your mind, that's your answer.
All right.
Right? What's your favorite Nigerian food?
Jollof rice.
Yeah, is that soup?
Nigerian soup.
No, food.
Oh, yeah, he said Nigerian soup. Yeah, jollof rice.
Favorite Nigerian soup?
Oha soup.
Okay. What was your best investment?
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin. With that guy. Wait, how early were you into Bitcoin?
It was Mustafa. Do you remember with Mustafa?
Man, what happened to Mustafa, man? Shout out to Mustafa if you're watching.
Yeah,
man.
There was a time I met up with Mustafa talk in about it back Abuja. Then. Yeah. So back when I was using BlackBerry, 2000, so very early.
Wait, what year? What year? Don't skip the year, because we can calculate based on the year.
But I didn't start buying it then. That's the thing.
Okay.
I think I heard it. I heard it from him first. Then it was at maybe $40. But yay. I was like, I don't know about this thing, Sha. Let me watch. You know, I took my sweet time. Maybe 2 years later.
So, okay, you could have turned everybody into big London. Goodness. It's a big London.
Bro, I would have been a whale by now. I started buying Bitcoin when it was at $90, right? So I did.
That's still something now.
No, but I didn't hold on the entire time. Oh. So I sold practically everything. So yes, I did. So wait, let me tell you.
Hold on.
So I started buying at $90.
Yeah.
And it went to like 4,500.
Okay.
Right. And then I sold to start doing my real estate, because in my mindset again, it's a good thing and a bad thing, but that risk management gene, you can't turn it off. I'm like, this thing can easily go down to whatever. So I sold a good portion of it, bought some properties. I bought my first property in the US around like maybe 2014. Locked that in my mind, like, at least I've locked in something, right? Now, by 2017, when we started buying coins, again, before we got into YC, I sold almost, I only had 2 Bitcoin left. By the time we started buy coins, I didn't start buying again until Bitcoin was that 2019, what led me to start buying again was I tried to do all the meme coins and everything. Bro, that's where I realized I'm not built for it, my brother. I got lucky a few times, but it was just too. So I'm like, you know what? I understand Bitcoin. I understand the mechanics of it. So I'm just going to keep buying. And thankfully, then it had dropped to like maybe around like 17K. So I started buying like smaller amounts, but I was just accumulating, and I've been accumulating since then. So actually the best return I've gotten from Bitcoin is much more the 2019 to date than the early one that I mean, I had a good return in terms of absolute return, but numbers wise, I think I went from like 10,000 to like almost like hundreds, a couple hundred. Mm-hmm. And that was decent, but in terms of proper money, it's much more the recent. Yeah. So Bitcoin is still my best investment.
What is your most expensive mistake?
Most expensive. I haven't made many, but that's a good, I don't know. Maybe with Bitcoins, I don't know. It's a mixed bag, right? Because part of there's a sense where the challenges that we had at the time, again, Timmy and I resolved it very maturely, but it was really much more a case that it was our first time doing something of that nature. And so in retrospect, there was a lot of things I could have done differently. And maybe if I did, we would have stayed in that business, right? And who knows what that would have happened, right? But we still resolved it amicably, and I left. And again, I left some money on the table, walked away from some money. And again, but what I'm doing at Rice has also sort of gone in the right direction as well. So I wouldn't say it's not a loss, but at the same time, if you apply your current wisdom backwards, you always find places you could have done something better.
And I want to talk about that, because it's funny, because I had a thing I posted on LinkedIn the other day about obedience and like listening to God's like word, in terms of, you know, sometimes you're like, let's take for example, I don't know the full details, right? But obviously you are co-founders of Bitcoin.
Right.
And then maybe something happens and you have to walk away, but you're leaving things on the table. But absolutely, what was that internal dialogue for you? And I don't know if you were super spiritual at the time, but what gave you the confidence to say, look, I helped build this, right? I'm going to walk away to go do something else. And you didn't have any guarantees that this next thing would work. So what was that internal dialogue for you?
So I think it was mostly, and it wasn't a very spiritual one. I've always been, I've been a Christian in a real sense since like 2013. Before, like outside of, you know, again, we had this period of like going crazy.
So FYI, me and AK used to write a blog together. Maybe we'll post it in a link, but this was back in the day.
No, please don't.
No, but yeah, it was an interesting
time. 2009, 2010
days, man. Yeah,
absolutely. But I became a Christian in 2013. So in some sense, maybe God was still looking out. But at the time it was just, okay, I always had, when you're young, you feel invincible. There was no sense that I wanted to do something, I couldn't do it, right? So it was like, oh, we have to do something new, bet. Let's go do it, right? But Timmy himself, funny enough, I don't know if he remembers, but he actually even encouraged me, right? Because after all, I'm like, yeah, we're going to have to part ways, because this is not really, it's not balanced. Not that it wasn't working entirely, but it's not quite balanced in the way we wanted to. I had some things I needed to do. I think the team had a different direction they wanted to go. So we just couldn't gel it. So after I left, and I was still, you know, doing some things on my real estate side and expanding the portfolio there, but I was also talking with people about stocks, and I was having a conversation with Timmy, and he was like, why don't you just do this as a startup? I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to get some other people, some other companies to just allow us to help them add dollar investments to their offerings, because I'm not in Nigeria full time.
Yeah.
And I feel like you need to be in Nigeria full time to make an idea like this work. But after I just kept thinking about it. I'm like, so by the time I was now ready, I was like, you know what? No one has done this. And, you know, I'm just going to do it. So, but that germ of an idea was planted in 2018, which was around when we finished YC. And then I was in San Francisco when we had that conversation. But I think it didn't even blossom until almost the end of 2019 when I was just like, you know what? What's stopping me from just going back to do this, right? So maybe it was God, maybe it was just life, but.
We had Austin O'Carry on the show, and he says that the best, in his opinion, the best co-founding team is a tripod. So where you have like three people who are starting a co-founding. Right. I think it was you, Timmy, and Ereb, basically, Ereb,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yes.
So, and he was basically breaking down how in those three, one person maybe is the CTO, the other person is like, you know, the ops person, and another person maybe can handle sales. What was the balance between you? And the reason why I'm asking this is when you now leave to go start RiseVest, you also have co-founders at RiseVest, absolutely, right? What was now your evolved thinking around the right sort of balance for a partnership when launching a startup?
I think we had the right partnership, in a way.
What were the roles? What were the different roles?
So mine was sort of business development and business lead. So I was always like the finance person, the market person. Timmy was the CTO and CEO in a sense. Ire was the ops person. She's very detail oriented and she's very, so we had a good balance. I think we just had that when we started having some difference in opinion. Some of it was just, again, for me, coming from consulting, it's just, the best idea should win. Now that I've done startups for a while, I realized that it's not like that. The person who is in charge of the vision, even if you're bringing a new idea, they need to be able to synthesize it to what they already had in mind, right? Yeah. So that's what led to that rift. But the balance was there. So when I started, again, right now I have the finance expertise, and I'm also still like the market person, right? The guy that is understanding the market and saying this is what to build. Bosson, who was my co-founder, is the builder, right? And then Tony is the data and operations person. So I think we still have pretty similar, but in this case, I think we've so far, you know, managed to build together.
But I want to really dig deeper into this, and not necessarily from a Bitcoin's perspective, because I think this is such a really good point. Because I think sometimes I have founders come up to me like, should I have a co-founder? Should I not have a co-founder? How many co-founders are necessary? In that dynamic, right? And I think now you have had a chance to look back at it. I say to some founders that in every dynamic like that, there's the person who, no matter what, that skin in the game is mostly on them, right?
Right.
And I think what happens sometimes in a co-founding perspective is people think, oh, because we're all three, then that means it's all balanced.
It's all balanced, right?
No, there's literally somebody where the buck stops with me.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm the one that, when this thing balances out, it's me that's going to make the decision. Absolutely. So I'm the person who has the ultimate skin in the game.
Yes.
Is that something that later on, when you reflected on that, you're like, okay, cool, this might be where a Timmy's perspective was being shaped by?
Absolutely.
Because now at RiseVest, I'm assuming, obviously, the buck stops ultimately.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's definitely, that's something that I had to learn. So again, coming from consulting, it's collegiate, right? Mm-hmm. It's partnership driven. Everyone's voice is the same. And then the best opinion wins. And in Bitcoins, Timmy is definitely the person who's like, I'm the quarterback, right? I'm building whatever we're doing. The vision, the connection between the vision and what I'm building needs to be 100%. And it didn't take me very long to realize that, okay, some of the things that I was pushing for, maybe would have still gotten to, right? But I needed to try and allow him to get to that point where it was clear that this is the next step, rather than try to force it because, you know, you're coming in from that. So that was, for me, a learning curve. And I think when I reached out to him maybe less than a year later, to tell him that, Omo, this is, you know, now I understand. He was like, yeah, but him too. He's like, but now I also get what you... So it was just we're all new,
yeah,
right? So, and now it's, I think for people who might be listening, it's even important that people don't look at, because we're three co-founders, right? All three of us, whoever has the most insight and the most responsibility for that vision should always be like the final. And that's why three is better than two.
Yeah.
Because with two, you have a difference of opinion. That's a problem. With three, there's usually like a tiebreaker, or the final decision person. And it's always a good idea to have the person in charge play that role.
So the final question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story do you think needs to be told?
I think I'd like to hear Yamo of Bamboo. I'd like to hear her story.
Yamo?
Yeah. Okay. Yamo of Bamboo.
Okay.
You know her, right?
No, but
she's co-founder of Bamboo.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is in our space, in general. One, she's one of my, I won't say my favorite persons, but we've shared a lot of ideas and I really like how she thinks. But also it's that there's not a lot of women in our space, right? Odun is one that is very visible. But I think Yamu is also there as well. And I would like to see how she's carved, because again, she's held her own and they've done really well. So I'd like to hear like how she's thought about how she moved in our space and how she navigates the reality of building in Nigeria. Because again, it's stressful, right? It's crazy. And people constantly second guess you. So it will be interesting to hear like how she navigated all of that.
Okay. Yama will be reaching out. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Thank you guys. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.